Imagine you are sitting at a stoplight, right? Like you have never had a speeding ticket. You pay your auto insurance premium on time every single month.
Yeah, you're a highly responsible person.
Exactly. Completely responsible. And then suddenly a pickup truck just slams into you from behind.
Oh, man.
Yeah, totaling your car and putting you in the hospital for a month. You are in immense pain, but financially you think you're covered. You have insurance, they have insurance, it is handled.
Right, you assume it's all sorted.
But then you find out that because of a single signature you made 12 years ago to save $40, you're entirely on your own for $31,000 in medical bills.
It is terrifying.
It really is. Today, we have our hands on this document. It's called auto.pdf. And I know it sounds super boring. It is a really detailed Wisconsin auto insurance agent training manual.
Oh, it is dense, super dense. But beneath all that bureaucratic jargon, it is actually a secret playbook. It lays out the exact mechanical traps currently hiding in your glove box, and our mission today is to decode the fine print so you are never blindsided. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really understand what this manual is telling us, we first have to fundamentally redefine what insurance actually is.
Right.
Because, most people conceptualize their auto policy as a sort of magical shield.
Like a force field around your car.
Yeah, exactly. But insurance doesn't prevent a crash.
Yeah.
The physical reality remains, right? The metal bends, the glass shatters, the injuries happen.
Right.
What this contract does, and it is strictly a contract, not a favor, is decide in advance whose checkbook that massive loss comes out of. It is purely a transfer of risk.
And to see just how unforgiving that contract can be, the manual brings up this really chilling real-world scenario. It involves a 78-year-old woman named Ruth Halverson.
Yeah, right. So she is driving her 2019 Kia Sportage on a Tuesday afternoon. She is stopped at the end of a driveway, just simply waiting for a gap in traffic to pull out.
Exactly. And the pickup truck behind her doesn't brake. He rear-ends her Kia with enough force to completely crumple the rear hatch right into the back seat.
Wow.
Yeah. Ruth survives, but the physical toll is brutal. I mean, she suffers a fractured wrist, requires neck surgery, and has to do like 12 weeks of intensive physical therapy.
And the bills rack up.
Oh, absolutely. When the dust settles, her medical bills alone stand at $31,000.
Now, the pickup driver was completely at fault here. He admitted it to the police at the scene. He was assured. So, in a logical world, his insurance pays Ruth his ills and we all move on.
Right, that would make sense.
But that is not what happens because he was carrying Wisconsin's state minimum limits for bodily injury. And that minimum is just $25,000.
Barely covers anything nowadays.
Exactly. So his insurance company writes a check for exactly 25 grand, and then they legally wash their hands of the entire situation.
Leaving Ruth with this massive gap, I mean, she still has $6,000 in outstanding medical bills, not to mention her lost household services and the pain and suffering she went through.
It doesn't even come close.
No, the $25,000 doesn't come close to making her whole. So Ruth's family does what anyone would do, right? They turn to her own insurance policy to cover the difference.
And this is where the heartbreak happens. Because the insurance company pulls her file, and sitting right behind the declarations page is a single yellowed sheet of paper from 2012.
Yep.
It is a standard form regarding underinsured motorist coverage,
Right.
or UIM. There is a box marked reject, and right next to it, Ruth's initials and her signature.
The agent actually made a handwritten note in the margins back in 2012. He calculated what the premium difference would have been if she had kept that protection. It was $40 a year.
Oh man, 40 bucks.
$40. For the sake of saving $40 annually, she legally instructed her insurance company that she did not want them to step in if she was hit by someone without enough coverage.
So she gets nothing.
Therefore, she gets absolutely nothing from her own policy for this crash.
Okay, hold on. I want to make sure I really understand the mechanics of this because it feels incredibly deceptive.
It does.
If I buy, say, $100,000 of this UIM coverage, I naturally assume I am buying a bucket of 100 grand that just gets poured on top of whatever the at-fault driver pays. Is that how it
Yeah,
works?
no, and that is a really common and dangerous misconception. The manual details that Wisconsin operates with what is called a reducing
A
clause.
reducing
Yeah,
clause. Okay.
yeah. Your UIM limit isn't a bonus on top. It represents the absolute maximum ceiling you can recover from all sources combined.
Wait, really?
Yes. So let's pretend Ruth had kept a $100,000 UIM limit. The math works like this. The policy takes her $100,000, subtracts the at-fault driver's $25,000, and that leaves $75,000 of available room in her own policy to cover her bills.
Oh, wow. So it actively reduces your payout by whatever the other guy pays.
Exactly. It reduces it dollar for dollar.
That is infuriating.
Yeah.
The math actively works against you. But even still, I mean, buying state minimums or letting a client sign away this coverage to save the equivalent of, like, a few cups of coffee, it is like buying a parachute that only opens halfway.
Right.
Why would an insurance agent, an industry professional, ever let a client make that choice without violently shaking them and explaining the math?
Well, this raises an important question, doesn't it? What is the agent's actual job? Because there is a massive gulf between a legal duty and an ethical duty.
Okay.
Legally, the agent's responsibility is surprisingly narrow. Act in good faith, carry out the client's instructions, and offer the minimum statutory requirements set by the state legislature.
So just tick the boxes.
Pretty much. Ethically. Yes, an agent should sit you down and explain the devastating reality of a reducing clause. But in the eyes of the law, that signed rejection form is an absolute shield for the agent.
It protects them from getting sued.
Exactly. It proved they offered the coverage, the client declined, and it protects the agency from an errors and omissions lawsuit.
Mm.
Ultimately, the consumer is the captain of the ship. If you sign it, you own the consequences.
Okay, so that gap in coverage is devastating when you are the victim trying to pull money from your own first-party policy. But let's flip the script.
Sure.
What if you, the listener, are the one whose vehicle causes the massive medical bills, whose policy takes a hit, because the manual dives into some deeply counterintuitive rules about who is actually covered when the keys change hands?
Oh, yeah. The overarching rule here, and it is the biggest shock for most consumers, is the omnibus clause. The simplest way to remember is this. Insurance follows the car, not the driver.
Which makes zero sense intuitively. Like, if I cause a crash, my insurance should pay. But let's look at the case of the borrowed Kia in the manual.
Right, Ella and Maddie.
Yeah. Ruth has a 16-year-old granddaughter, Ella.
Yeah.
Ella is hanging out with her friend Maddie, and Ella lets Maddie borrow the car to run up to the grocery store.
Just a quick errand.
Yep. Maddie gets to an intersection. She misjudges the oncoming traffic, turns left, and violently strikes a cyclist. The cyclist is a 41-year-old nurse. She suffers a broken pelvis, requires multiple surgeries, and is out of work for 6 months.
Now, Maddie's parents are wealthy. They have top-tier gold standard insurance with massive limits.
Right.
So the natural assumption is that, well, Maddie made the mistake, so Maddie's parents' insurance will swoop in and handle this broken pelvis.
Right. Maddie was driving. It is her fault.
But the omnibus clause says otherwise. Because Maddie was a permissive user, meaning she had permission from the family to use the vehicle, the Halverson family's insurance policy, the policy tied to the physical Kia, takes the primary hit. It absorbs the full force of the lawsuit first. Maddie's parents' pristine insurance policy acts strictly as a secondary backup, only kicking in if the Halverson's limits are completely exhausted.
Wait, so the Halverson family, who wasn't even in the vehicle, who did absolutely nothing wrong other than being generous with their keys, has their policy drained and their future rates destroyed because of Maddie's left turn?
Precisely, because insurance companies underwrite the vehicle. They price the risk based on where that car is parked, how heavy it is, and what its safety features are.
That is wild.
Yeah. When you hand over your keys, you are handing over your financial life.
And it gets even more complicated when we look at how the state calculates exactly whose fault the crash actually was. Because if things get messy, Wisconsin doesn't just split the bill evenly.
No, they don't. They use a highly unforgiving legal doctrine called modified comparative negligence.
That sounds intense.
It is. To understand this, you have to think of a courtroom jury assigning blame on a 100-point scale. If a jury finds you 50% at fault for a crash and the other driver 50% at fault, you can still recover half of your damages.
Okay, that seems fair.
But if the jury decides you are just a fraction more responsible, say 51% at fault, you hit a legal cliff. You recover absolutely nothing. Zero.
I need to wrap my head around this cliff. Let's say I am in a 3-car pileup on the highway. It is a complete mess. The jury looks at the evidence and says, okay, I am 40% at fault.
Okay.
The second driver is 35% at fault. And the third driver is 25% at fault. Since the other two drivers are collectively 60% responsible, which is the majority of the blame, I can at least get some of my car paid for, right?
You would really think so, but no. The harsh arithmetic of the 51% rule in Wisconsin compares your fault separately against each individual defendant, not their collective total. Yeah, So the court looks at your 40% and compares it to the second driver's 35%. Since your number is higher, you get nothing from them.
Wow.
Then they compare your 40% to the third driver's 25%. Again, yours is higher. You walk away with nothing, even though the group as a whole made more mistakes than you did.
It is like getting an F on a group project just because you wrote one bad paragraph while the other two plagiarized their entire section.
That is a great way to put it.
The state is basically saying they refuse to reward a plaintiff who holds the lion's share of the blame in any individual matchup.
Exactly. It prevents people who caused most of the problem from profiting off their own bad driving. And speaking of the courtroom, if that cyclist with the broken pelvis decides to sue the Halverson family over Maddie's left turn, there is a psychological weapon the plaintiff gets to use in Wisconsin.
What kind of weapon?
It is called direct action. In most states, if you sue over a car crash, the lawsuit is simply Smith versus Halverson. The jury just sees two neighbors arguing over a crash.
Right. It feels personal.
But in a direct action state, you can sue the insurance company by name. The lawsuit becomes Smith versus Halverson and State Farm Auto.
Oh, that changes everything.
It does. The jury walks into the courtroom and physically sees the deep corporate pockets sitting right there at the defense table. It entirely changes the psychology. The jury doesn't feel the guilt of bankrupting a local family. They feel like they are just extracting money from a faceless billion-dollar corporation.
Honestly, knowing how quickly a policy can bleed hundreds of thousands of dollars on a single left turn and how stacked the courtroom can be, it's really no wonder premiums are rising across the board.
Absolutely.
The manual actually features a section where the Halverson family receives a renewal bill in the mail. It is 19% higher than it was just 6 months ago. They have no tickets. They have zero claims. They're driving the exact same cars. So what does this all mean? Why the massive unprovoked jump?
Because your premium is not an isolated grade on your personal driving test. It is a reflection of the shared risk pool.
Okay, so it's everyone's fault.
Basically. The manual breaks down three massive hidden factors driving up costs for everyone. First, the pure severity of the repairs and the technology involved. By 2025, the average auto repair cost hit $4,818.
That is steep.
And if you drive an electric vehicle, that cost is about 47% higher than a gas equivalent.
Is that just because the parts are harder to source?
Partly, yes, but it is really about the sensors. The manual highlights ADAS Advanced Driver Assistance Systems. A bumper used to be just a dumb piece of curved plastic. You tap it, you buff it out, or replace the plastic.
Right. It was simple.
Today, a bumper is a highly sensitive nervous system of radar, sonar, and cameras. Even a 5-mile-per-hour fender bender that leaves barely a scratch now requires a $550 diagnostic sensor calibration to make sure the lane keep assist isn't permanently blinded.
So even if I am driving a 2008 Honda Civic, my rates are going up. Because if I rear-end someone else's new Tesla, my insurance company has to pay the tech tax to recalibrate their computer bumper.
Precisely. You're subsidizing the tech. The second factor is localized crime, specifically what happened with the Kia Boys phenomenon in places like Milwaukee.
I remember hearing about that.
Yeah. Certain Kias and Hyundais were manufactured without standard engine immobilizer chips. A design flaw meant thieves could break the steering column and start the car using nothing but a standard USB cable.
Just a USB cable.
Yeah.
And the insurance companies have to pay out for all those stolen vehicles.
Millions of dollars in massive comprehensive claims. It became a viral trend, resulting in huge class action settlements. The sheer volume of those payouts gets distributed across the state's premiums.
Of course it does.
And finally, the third factor, weather. Wisconsin is experiencing severe shifts. Oh. The manual notes extreme flooding and a record number of tornadoes in 2025, including a massive EF3 near Appleton.
Oh, wow.
When a tornado rips the roof off a dealership or floods a suburban neighborhood, turning hundreds of cars into scrap metal overnight, the insurance industry categorizes those as massive other than collision claims.
So basically, my monthly bill is a forced GoFundMe for the neighborhood's bad weather, a tech tax for the computers in other people's bumpers, and a bailout fund for car manufacturers who forgot to install security chips.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that profound consumer frustration is exactly why the insurance industry is aggressively pushing telematics.
Right, the apps.
Yes. Those are the smartphone apps or plug-in devices that track your hard braking, your late-night driving, and whether you touch your phone while in motion. It is the industry's attempt to transition away from pricing your demographics and your zip code, and instead price the actual physical physics of your daily commute.
But speaking of daily commutes, we really need to talk about how your everyday lifestyle choices can actually void your policy completely without you even realizing it. Because environmental factors will raise your rates, but the gig economy can leave you totally uninsured.
Oh, absolutely.
Put yourself in this scenario. Think about your weekend. Let's say you decide to pick up a Saturday night DoorDash gig to make some extra cash for vacation. Seems totally harmless, right?
It seems harmless until you blow a stop sign and cause an accident. There is a massive gap in how the law treats the gig economy.
How so?
Well, transportation network company laws, which heavily regulate passenger apps like Uber and Lyft, mandate very specific periods of coverage depending on whether the driver is just logged into the app or actually engaged in a ride with a passenger in the back seat. But delivering food is not legally considered a TNC.
Wait, really? Driving a person and driving a burrito are treated differently by the law?
Completely differently. Delivering goods falls under standard livery clauses in a personal auto policy. A personal policy is priced for a person driving to work or the grocery store. When you deliver food, you are engaging in commercial activity.
Right, you're basically a delivery truck.
Exactly. You are driving more miles, you are on a strict timeline, you are checking an app while moving, and you are parking erratically. Your risk profile skyrockets. Because of that livery exclusion, the literal second you tap accept on that burrito order, you are driving completely uninsured.
That is terrifying.
Unless you have actively purchased a specific commercial delivery endorsement, your insurance company will outright deny the claim.
One burrito voids a $500,000 liability policy. Just insane. And the manual does a full inventory of other blind spots hiding in the average garage, too.
Oh, the garage is a minefield of uninsured liability. E-bikes are a perfect example.
E-bikes, really?
Yeah. If you buy a standard Class 2 e-bike off the shelf, the liability for hitting a pedestrian is usually covered under your homeowner's or renter's policy. But if your teenager buys a modification kit online and slaps a 1,000-watt motor on it, the law suddenly classifies that bicycle as a motor vehicle.
And let me guess, motor vehicles need auto insurance.
Exactly. Because it's a motor vehicle not explicitly listed on an auto policy, there is absolutely zero coverage if they cause a crash. The same goes for taking a golf cart off your own property onto a public road or riding a snowmobile in public trails without a standalone policy.
And out on those public roads, we have to talk about the most ubiquitous Wisconsin hazard of all. Deer, the November menace.
The statistics in the manual are just staggering. There are roughly 17,795 deer crashes a year in the state.
Wow.
If you do the math, that is one deer strike every 12.2 hours.
I know there is a golden rule when it comes to deer and insurance.
Yeah.
Explain the mechanics of why we have to react the way we do.
The golden rule is don't swerve. The mechanics of the insurance claim change entirely based on what your bumper hits. If an animal leaps in front of you and you hit the deer, the industry views that as an act of nature.
Right.
It is processed as a comprehensive or other than collision claim. You typically pay a much lower deductible. And crucially, there is no at-fault surcharge applied to your future premiums.
Because you didn't do anything wrong. The deer just spawned in front of you.
Correct. But human instinct is to jerk the steering wheel to avoid the animal, right?
Yeah, of course.
If you swerve, miss the deer entirely, and hit a telephone pole or a ditch, the insurance company views that as you failing to maintain control of your vehicle. It instantly becomes a collision claim. You are deemed at fault, you pay your higher collision deductible, and your rates will likely suffer for the next 3 to 5 years.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because swerving for a deer is an innocent, instinctual mistake. But the manual details scenarios where the hazard in front of you isn't an animal. It's a malicious, highly coordinated trap. This transitions us into the dark side of auto insurance, like organized crime on the highway.
Yeah, the manual breaks down a scenario involving Mike Halverson driving his F-150 on Interstate 94 near Johnson Creek. He is cruising in the middle lane when a dark sedan cuts him off, pulling into his lane with maybe a foot of clearance.
Okay.
And then for absolutely no reason, the sedan slams on its brakes with maximum force.
Now, in the manual scenario, Mike manages to stop in time because his new truck has that automatic emergency braking we talked about earlier with the ADAS stuff. But what happens if he was driving an older truck and rear-ended them?
If he had rear-ended them, Mike would have been the victim of what investigators call a swoop and swat. It is a choreographed, staged accident executed by organized crime rings.
How does that even work?
Here is how it works. A swoop car intentionally cuts off a squat car right in front of the victim. The squat car slams on the brakes to avoid the swoop car. The victim, who has nowhere to go, rear-ends the squat car.
And because the law generally dictates that if you hit someone from behind, it's your fault for following too closely, Mike is instantly legally at fault.
Exactly. The swoop car speeds off into traffic so they can never be identified. But here's the real scam. The squat car that Mike just hit is packed with 4 or 5 passengers.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah. The next morning, every single one of them goes to a specific shady medical clinic, often called a medical mill. They all claim soft tissue injuries like whiplash, which are incredibly painful but virtually impossible to disprove on an X-ray.
Right. You can't see pain.
Exactly. The clinic racks up $40,000 in arbitrary treatment bills, and the crime ring demands a massive settlement from Mike's insurance company.
I mean, I would be losing my mind if I knew I was being scammed like that.
Yeah.
Does the insurance industry even care, or is this just a rounding error to them?
Oh, they care deeply, because the financial bleed is catastrophic. Insurance fraud costs the United States roughly $308.6 billion a year.
Billion? With a B.
With a B. That stolen money doesn't just vanish, you know. It is recouped through premiums. That fraud adds roughly $900 a year to every single honest policyholder's premium. You are paying for those staged crashes every time you renew your policy.
But the manual also highlights that the most common form of fraud isn't happening at 70 miles an hour on the interstate. It's white-collar fraud happening quietly at the agent's desk.
Right. It is called rate evasion. It happens when a customer intentionally lies to their agent to manipulate the underwriting algorithm.
Like lying about where you park.
Yes, lying about your garaging address. Let's say you live in the dense, high-traffic center of Milwaukee, but you tell your agent you park your car at your parents' house in a quiet suburb like Cedarburg to lock in those cheaper rates. Or lying by omitting a newly licensed teenage driver living in your house to dodge the massive premium hike.
And people do this all the time. They think of it as a victimless white lie, just finding a clever loophole to save $50 a month.
But legally, it is material misrepresentation. It is fraud. And the consequence isn't just that the insurance company might deny a specific claim if they catch you. The legal mechanism they use is called rescission.
Rescission.
Yeah. If they investigate a crash and realize you lied about your zip code, they can go to a judge and declare that your policy was built on a lie, and therefore, it legally never existed in the first place.
Wait, they just erase it?
They literally rewrite history to erase your coverage. You are left completely uninsured, personally facing a massive lawsuit on your own, facing potential bankruptcy, all because you tried to game the system for $50 a month on the front end.
Wow. Okay, we have covered some incredibly serious, deeply mechanical ground today. We started with the sheer heartbreak of Ruth's $40 signature that completely deleted her safety net.
Yeah, that was rough.
We walked through the terrifying arithmetic of the 51% liability cliff, unpacked the hidden technology costs inflating everyone's premiums, explored how one burrito delivery can void your entire policy, and exposed the literal criminal conspiracies waiting to trap you on the interstate.
It's a lot.
It really is. For you listening, you are now armed with the absolute why behind all that mind-numbing paperwork. You are officially the most informed person in any room when it comes to understanding how risk is actually managed.
What's fascinating here is, you know, if we look forward, the training manual mentions how ADS, those advanced driver assistance systems, are drastically cutting down the frequency of crashes. Mike's truck automatically braking during the swoop and squat is proof of that technology working.
Right.
But follow that trend to its logical conclusion. If we reach full vehicular autonomy, where the cars are entirely driving themselves, does human fault disappear entirely?
That is a wild thought.
Right. In 20 years, will personal auto insurance even need to exist? Or will every single car crash simply bypass traffic court and become a massive commercial product liability lawsuit against the software developers who coded the AI?
That is a wild paradigm shift to think about. I want you to really mull that over the next time you take your hands off the wheel and let your car parallel park itself, because the entire game of liability might be changing right beneath our feet. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the hidden mechanics of risk. And remember, keep a very close eye on that secret playbook currently sitting in your glove box. We will catch you next time.